of the series that we've been doing on landlord-tenant issues. And today I wanted to discuss some of the landlord-tenant issues that arose during the course of the coronavirus pandemic. And I have here in the materials three different case scenarios to discuss. And these all came up in terms of shilas that Bati Din had to deal with and the post-game had to deal with. There were tshuvos that were written by Rasha Weiss on the subject, by Yitzchak Zilberstein on the subject, and so forth. So one is a young couple was renting a home in Israel and was scheduled to visit their parents in Israel for Pesach. Shortly before Pesach, this is last Pesach, the coronavirus broke out and nobody could really predict for how long this pandemic would last, as we all know. The couple decided to go to America anyway and discovered that after Pesach, they would not be allowed back to Israel. They promptly notified the landlord that they would no longer be able to pay rent. Landlord responded that the lease was still in effect for 6 more months, and therefore they needed to pay until the end of that term. Who is correct?
Is it possible that the end of 6 months would be
the visit of
America for Pesach?
Yeah.
Yes, that is correct. Just testing you to see if you're paying attention. They were scheduled to visit their parents in America for Pesach. So that's why they wanted to go to America. So the question is, what do we say in this type of a scenario? When is it that a tenant can break a lease? So we said, if there is like some major onus, there is some major catastrophe that prevents a tenant from continuing to pay rent, and the tenant gets very sick, for example, so then there's a question mark as to whether a tenant is allowed to break a lease in the middle without having to pay rent for the rest of the term. It's a machlokes between the Mordechai and the Rashba about a situation where we mentioned a person was renting property for the year, and then the person died in the middle of the year. That certainly is an unforeseen circumstance. Does the estate have to continue to pay rent for the rest of the year? And we mentioned, according to the Rashba, yes, the estate is on the hook and they have to pay rent for the rest of the year. According to the Mordechai, no, we say that this is an onus. This is circumstances, you know, beyond the tenant's control. The tenant is now dead. That's really, you know, beyond the tenant's control. And therefore, the estate does not have to pay anymore. And the Ramah paskins that we make a sort of a compromise. It's in Kosha Mishpah, Simen Hashin Lam Medalad, where the Ramah said that it really depends that in the event that the rest of the rent has not yet been paid, then the estate does not have to pay for the rest of the term. Obviously, they're not going to remain on the premises. They're breaking the lease. Now the landlord can use the premises for his or her own purposes. However, if the rent was already paid, so then that indicates that there was sort of an acquisition that was being made by the tenant and the tenant's family of the space, the same way that you would buy a piece of real estate, that you take a risk if anything should happen to that real estate afterwards. So they're taking the risk. It's like a partial purchase of the property, as we've discussed before. And therefore, in such a case, the rent does not get paid back. However, to the extent that the landlord has a little bit of savings, that now there isn't the wear and tear that would normally occur if there were tenants that were occupying the property, so a certain discount should be provided for the fact that the landlord is getting that windfall. That's the opinion of the Mordechai, but the Ramah paskins, in the event that the amount was paid, since the Rashba held that the entire amount has to be paid anyway, so if once the landlord has the money, the landlord could say, I hold like the Rashba, and I'm not returning any of the money. So that's how the Ramah codifies this halacha. Then there's a question, though, as to whether this is applicable to other situations where there is a type of accident that occurs. The Aruch HaShulchan says that the only time that the tenant is off the hook is when we're talking about a tenant that dies. So then we say that we can't really compel the tenant to pay the rest of the money because the tenant's not alive anymore and we're not going to burden the family. But if the tenant's alive, just something happens to the tenant, so the tenant is not able to use the premises for the rest of the lease, so then the tenant really would be on the hook. And it's a little bit of a question mark in such a circumstance. So much so that in Siman Shin Yud Beis in Choshen Mishpat, which also deals with how this is, you could look in the source above over here, which also deals with what happens in the event that a house falls down or a house is burned down and that the tenant had specifically rented only this particular house, this particular space. The landlord then is not responsible to rebuild a new house or a new space. There's actually an opinion, according to the Sma, this doesn't find its way in the Shulchan Aruch, according to the Sma, there's an opinion that the Rama intended to record, but just it was inadvertently omitted. It says that if a house gets, if a house becomes incinerated, then it's the tenant's bad luck, and the tenant still has to pay for the rest of the lease. And the Rama says, but of course, but there's an opinion that says, no, the house is not around anymore, the tenant doesn't have to pay for the rest of the lease. That's in a regular situation, yes.
Is that true if the policy provides rent for the landlord? Is that what your statement?
The policy, which policy?
I mean, the insurance policy? Policy provides rent.
If insurance policy, you know, we can always kick in. That's why people buy insurance. But here we're talking about a case where there's no insurance. But the Rama says, if it was not only this house that burned down, let's say it was the Great Fire of Chicago, and all of the houses, all the buildings of Chicago, the entire area, they all burned down. So then that's what we call a Makas Medina. So Makas Medina. Makas Medina means that this is an affliction. It is an accident that not only affects this tenancy, this particular contract, but it affects like all the homes in the entire region. You can't say it's the tenant's bad luck that something happened if it happens to be a Makas Medina. What's the source for that? The source for that is a Gemara, a Mishnah in Gemara in Bava Metzia. That's the first source here. Daf Kofei on the base. It says that if there is a person who is renting, let's say, a field, and they are paying a certain amount to be on the field, and now there is some type of plague of locusts that hits the field, or the field is hit by windstorms and now there are no crops, so the person who is the land tenant is not able to get any benefit from it. So the Mishnah says that if it's not a Makas Medina, if it's not a type of affliction that happened to affect all the fields in the region, but just this particular field, we say it's the land tenant's bad luck. And in a menakalo in chakuro, he has to pay the full rent. Chakuro means the rental of the field. However, if it's a Makas Medina, if, however, it is an affliction, it is some sort of a catastrophe that affects the entire region, we can't say that it is the tenant's bad luck. Rather, it's, as the Aruch HaShulchan puts it, it's Mishamaya Kagazru Alev, that it is some sort of act of God that affects the entire region, not the tenant's bad luck. And then we say that the land tenant is allowed not to pay rent, except to the degree that they were still able to get some benefit from the field. If the land tenant wasn't able to get any benefit from the field, so then the land tenant doesn't have to pay any rent whatsoever. So the Rama therefore says, similarly, if you have a situation where it's a Makas Medina, that all of the houses are affected, that everybody's house got got incinerated in a major fire. So then the tenant for sure is off the hook. Not only is the tenant off the hook, but unlike the situation of the tenant that died midway through the lease, where if the tenant or the estate had already paid for the rent for the duration of the term, and now after the tenant dies, the estate says, the heirs say, we don't need this property anymore, so we want to break the lease. Once the landlord has already received the money, so the Rama says, well, the landlord doesn't return the money in such a case. So here the Rama says, even if the money was already paid, if it's a Makas Medina, the money actually has to be returned to the tenant in such a case. So how do you understand a situation where a house still remains intact? The property is still there. The property is still present. It didn't burn down in a fire or anything like that. But you have a Makas Medina that causes the houses in a particular region to be unusable. Like, for example, there's a Magepa, there's an epidemic, and everybody flees from the city because of the epidemic. The Posek, the Maram, Mipadova, who lived around the same time as the Shulchan Aruch. So he wrote a tshuva about this. He says that if you have an epidemic that causes people to run away from the city, like everybody runs away in order to go to a more safe and healthy region, then that was also Tzidkas Medina. It's a little bit of a question. Does everybody have to run away? Just have to be most of the people who run away? But it's certainly a situation where everybody basically has to flee, then for sure that's also considered to be a Makas Medina. And he says it doesn't even have to affect an entire country. It just has to affect a particular region. If in that particular region, it becomes unlivable, so then this would be the case. So there's a discussion in the Shulchan Aruch regarding, this is towards the end of Simon Shin Lamed Dalet, Nukos Shemishbar. You have this, you look in source of Yud Gimel in the Mishnah, for example, discusses this is a situation where there is a Shinoi Avir. There is a change in atmosphere, climate change. So you think that we're the only ones who have this notion of climate change. They had climate change way back then, going back hundreds of years ago. This was always a thing, the notion of climate change. So because of Shinoi Avir, is a climate change, if that causes people to leave a particular region, if somebody has a rental contract, and because he had to leave the region, so he says, I don't want to have to pay the rest of my lease. I want to break the lease. So the Maharam Titin ruled that nothing doing. In this particular case, it doesn't matter that it's a Makas Medina. The fact is the building or the property is still standing. And so, since the property is still standing, therefore, there's no good excuse not to pay for the property just because he's running away. He has to pay for the property for the duration of the lease. The Shach casts a question upon this. It's Sarachi and Medina. That doesn't seem to make sense to me. Points out that in an analogous case regarding a worker, we say that a worker doesn't lose his wages. The Baal HaBayis is not, you know, off the hook. If we're looking at, you know, the person who otherwise, you know, would have to pay the wages, the Baal HaBayis is not off the hook if the reason why let's say differently, I'm sorry, that if there is a Shinoi Avir, it's the other way around, that the Baal HaBayis, the person who had hired the poel, who had hired the worker, would not have to pay a worker, let's say you have a teacher who teaches, you know, the children, and because and all the schools have to close, because there's some terrible epidemic, sounds familiar, there's a Shinoi Avir and everybody has to run away. So the Ramaz, he says over there that there would be no obligation to pay the Malamed, to pay the teacher if there is, you know, some type of a calamitous event that causes everybody to flee from the town. It seems to be in contradiction to a ruling of the Ramaz elsewhere regarding whether or not you have to pay teachers, but that's not the subject of, you know, this year, since we're not talking about paying teachers. That's a totally different subject. We're talking about paying rent. But certainly over here, the indication is that one, you know, would be off the hook. So similarly, the Shach says I'm having to pay. So similarly, the Shach says that it would seem that you should not have to pay the rest of your rental contract either. And the Taz also rules accordingly that you wouldn't have to pay the rest of your rental contract. So the postgame looked at this question of Makas Medina in the context of the coronavirus, people who could not use their property. How would it be you couldn't use your property? Here we're not talking about a Shinoi Avir, that because there's some terrible change in the climate, that as a result, nobody can use their property. No, if anything, everybody can use their property. You just have to shelter in place. Yeah, you know, there's no place to run to. There's a pandemic. It affects the entire world. So obviously, we're not talking about a situation where you can run from one city to another city. On the other hand, in the early days of the coronavirus, so Rav Asher Weiss pointed out that people were very, very nervous if they had, you know, plans to go to their parents in America. They were afraid of being stuck somewhere, especially young couples, where they didn't have their parental support. You have your small children, and, you know, it's a big deal to have your parental support. And they were very nervous about being caught in the throes of the coronavirus, especially if their support system was in America. So they wanted to run to America. So he said, for that group of people, that this discernible, you know, group that were all nervous about not being able to have their support system at the beginning of the coronavirus and wanted to go back to America. So he said, in a way, that's like, you know, fleeing based on the Makas Medina. So maybe then they shouldn't have to pay their rent, especially given that they couldn't necessarily have anticipated that after a couple of weeks of being home for Pesach, that there would be sort of, you could call this a Makas Medina as well, a decree by the Israeli government that nobody would be allowed to go back to Israel. They couldn't necessarily have known that they couldn't, that they wouldn't be able to go back to Israel afterwards. And therefore, when that eventually occurred, so perhaps you might be able to treat this as a Makas Medina. However, this would only be a justification for breaking a lease. If, for example, the people had a one-year lease, and now they had been there for 6 months, turns out that they can't return anymore, so now they want to get out of it, so then you could say, okay, maybe this counts as a Makas Medina. That is a separate question. It was that really true that nobody could return? There's a rule that Tosfos mentions in connection, Baba Metzia, in connection with Makas Medina, that let's say that all the fields of a particular area are basically ruined, but they're not completely ruined. It's just that a person has to go further. Now the water supply has dried up, but there's another water supply which is a few hundred yards further away, and with some extra trouble and extra effort, they'll be able to fill up the water from this other spring, and they'll be able to irrigate their field. So with a little bit of extra torah with tachulos, a little bit of extra work and toil, they'll be able to ameliorate the situation. Tosa says that doesn't count as a Makas Medina. With a little bit of extra work, you'll be able to ameliorate the situation. It's not considered to be a Makas Medina, because then that's the job of the person to work a little bit harder. So maybe there was the possibility of going into a hotel for 2 weeks and quarantining, and then after a two-week quarantine to be able to go back to the premises. So maybe that counts as a legitimate amount of effort that everybody should have been expected to expend. So Rav Asher Weiss, in writing about this issue, this is in his Tkufas HaKorona Madura Tlisa, Simon Yud Zayin through Simon Yud Tes. So he says, yeah, you could make an argument, but the truth of the matter is that every single case kind of is very fact-specific, and it's not always so feasible, especially for a young couple with small children, to go through all of the hoops that it would have taken to go back to Israel afterwards. So he thought that there would be a legitimate argument to break the lease under these circumstances. But that is when we're speaking about breaking the lease. Even there, I was in touch with one of the Dayanim on the West Coast, Rabbi Avi Leibowitz, who's a brother of Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz, who's the director of the Smicha program at YU. And we were discussing these inyanim at the time, and he thought that you could make a strong argument that it doesn't count as a Makas Medina unless it's a completely unexpected event. We call the act of God is completely unexpected. If the people were leaving from Israel, from their apartments, at the beginning of the coronavirus, they were taking a calculated risk because they knew the coronavirus was already in the air, so to speak. They knew there was a chance that maybe the state of Israel would not allow them to go back after Israel. You're taking calculated risk. So you can't say that this is just some sudden, unexpected accident or some unexpected set of circumstances that gives you the right to break your lease. So you can argue different ways with respect to this particular situation. Some of the poskim that wrote about these situations earlier on, there was a rabban, Marami Ruthenberg, that spoke about people who had to break a lease because of a plague. So they said that really everybody should take a little bit of a hit, because you can't say that it's the bad luck of the tenant. You can't say it's the bad luck of the landlord. So they said that if the rent was already paid, so the landlord should return 50% of the rent. So some suggested that as a pshara, as a compromise, maybe in these cases, 50% of the rent should be paid under these circumstances. That would, again, be more difficult to argue when the rent had not yet been paid. But if you deal with a situation where, let's say, they don't necessarily want to break the lease entirely, and this relates to the second scenario, but let's say that the tenant wants to be relieved from having to pay rent during the time that the tenant can't use the premises, but the tenant wants to reserve the right to use the premises afterwards. What do you say about such a case? They want to reserve the right to use the premises afterwards. So you have this with a lot of the business lease situations, where the businesses, were closed down by the government, non-essential businesses, for example, for a period of time where they couldn't make any money off the business. They couldn't show up for work, but they still wanted to, if they had, let's say, a two-year lease, they wanted to be able to keep their leases in place so that as soon as the businesses would open up again, they'd be able to use the premises. On the other hand, they didn't want to have to pay rent for the period of time that they couldn't use the premises. So what do you say in that case? Do you say that they get a rent abatement, that they don't have to pay for the period of time it's unusable, but at the same time, the landlord can't use the space either because the tenant is still storing all of its furniture and wares and inventory in the space? So why should the landlord have to suffer and allow the space to be used in this fashion without getting any benefit or any rent whatsoever? So that's the second question. Non-essential business was forced to close temporarily during the coronavirus during the middle of a two-year lease. The business owners implored the landlord to forgive their rent during the time of the closure. The landlord responded they could break the lease entirely and remove all their belongings. Like we said in the previous case, you want to break the lease? Fine, break the lease. I'll try to rent it out to somebody else. But if they insisted on maintaining the lease, they needed to pay the full rent. Who prevails in this case? So this is similar to a case that the Ramad discusses when the Maharam Mipadava, just like we quoted him before in that Tshuva, where he talks about an epidemic being a Makas Medina. So he talks about another sort of strange situation being a Makas Medina, where a person had rented a store for, it was really a concession. The person, they rented space, but the space was for a very specific concession. It was for the right to lend money to non-Jews with interest. And they would make a lot of money by engaging in these interest-bearing loans. And that was why they rented the space for a period of time. And then unexpectedly, the government made a decree required that they not be allowed anymore to loan money with interest to non-Jews, unless there were certain rules and regulations that were followed, the taking of a certain collateral and things like that, that were just not feasible for people to be able to do in order to make these loans work. And therefore, as a result, the entire concession that had been paid for ended up being essentially worthless. So the tenant wanted to deduct the amount of money that was being paid for the period of time that the tenant wasn't able to lend out with interest to non-Jews. And the tenant was negotiating, you know, with governmental officials to change the rules so that the tenant would be able to do it again. But he wanted a rent abatement during the period that he was engaged in these negotiations. The Maharam Mipadava said, you don't get a rent abatement. You have the right to break the lease. In the case that the Gemara talks about, regarding the land tenant is deducting from their lease amount, not mikanalava, not prospectively, but retrospectively. The tenant worked on the land and tilled the crops and planted the soil and worked the entire year, and everything got ruined and everything got eaten by the locusts. Everything got blown away and ruined by the wind. So therefore, that's retroactively that we're not making the tenant pay. But if the tenant would want to stay on the land for the following year, so then the tenant would have to pay. It's just we're only talking about a retroactive abatement. But if the tenant wants to remain, despite the circumstances, and try to work things out or hope for the best for the future, so then there's an obligation to pay. And the Ramah says, no, the idea of an abatement is not just retroactive, but the idea of the abatement is prospective as well. If there's a Makas Medina, we don't force the tenant to break the lease. We give the tenant an abatement. So who do we hold like? Do we hold like the Maharam Mipadava? Do we hold like the Ramah? That's a machlokes among the different poskim. Some poskim say that we hold like the Ramah. The Shach says no. The Shach says that we hold like the Maharam Mipadava. So this is very relevant. This machlokes, this question is very relevant to all these business type situations. So for example, Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein ruled that if a tenant decides not to break the lease, maybe we give them permission to break the lease under these circumstances, because it's a Makas Medina, like you have a fire that causes all the houses to fall down. Maybe we would say, even though the property itself is not affected, nonetheless, we still, it's like a shinoy aver, it's like a change of climate, and the houses are not, you know, usable anymore. So you can make such an argument, but that's only if you want to break the lease, if you want to not use the space anymore, but you're still going to keep your wares and your inventory in the area. So then you got to pay then you have to pay the full amount. So that seems to be going like the opinion of the Maharam Mipadava says that if you stay, you have to pay the full amount. However, the reality is that one can certainly argue that if they haven't paid the money yet, that they have the right to rely upon the opinion of the Rama, who says that you do get a certain amount of abatement because you don't get a full use of the space. So what you have to look at under those circumstances is whether that's really true, that one could not get a full use of the space. Do we say that if the person was very creative and resourceful, they could have used, you know, the space? Well, if it's a situation where the government had basically, you know, shut down businesses and that there was no way a person would be able to make money and nobody would be able to rent the space, and realistically, the landlord couldn't have been able to rent the space to anybody, then it seems under these circumstances that it would be perfectly legitimate for the person to insist upon a rent abatement under these circumstances. And you just have to figure out what is the right amount. You can't say that the person should pay zero, because if the landlord isn't, you know, is allowing the space to be used and the person is storing their inventory and equipment, you know, in the space, so they should pay something for it. So Weiss had suggested that maybe that amount be, you know, that they just pay for whatever a person would normally pay for storage. So if the rental would have been, let's say, you know, $1,000 a month, and a person would normally pay $200, you know, a month for storage, so that's the amount, you know, that you would take into account. But what about if you're dealing with the other situation, the first situation of the young couple? Well, when you're dealing with a business, so maybe the landlord wouldn't have been able to rent out the business to anybody because of the fact the government had closed down all the businesses, but people still were looking for places to stay. It could be that a couple that went to America would not be able to go back and use their space in Israel, where there were plenty of Israelis that were still renting out spaces. I mean, one thing about the pandemic is that you could still live any place in the world. It's just that you weren't supposed to go outside of your home more than was absolutely necessary, but you certainly could take advantage of, there was no place that was more dangerous than some other place in terms of the atmospheric conditions of being inside of your house. So homes were still being rented at that time. So if you have this young couple that doesn't want to have to pay at all because they want to be able to reserve the right to return, in the meantime, the apartment's just sitting there for a few months and they're reserving, you know, the right to come back afterwards, it would seem that it would be appropriate to pay at least something to the landlord. As I said, according to Rabbi Leibowitz, maybe if they could have anticipated, they wouldn't be let back in, they should pay 100%. Even Rabbi Weiss agreed that in such a case, they should have to pay 50%. Let's look at the last question.
Rule, like a 50%.
I say he ruled 50%. And this is consistent with the approach that many poskim took, like in employment situations, the Makas Medina. Like, let's say you have a Makas Medina situation. As a result, you can't, you have no use for your teachers anymore because everybody has to leave the region and now the teachers can't teach. But the teachers would have been happy to teach. It's just that they can't teach anymore because either there was a decree from the government not allowing teachers to teach, or there was some plague and everybody had to leave. So does that mean that the teachers don't have to get paid at all? So there is a three-way machlokes. According to one opinion, which seems to be what the Rama says in one place, the teachers get paid 100%. According to another opinion, which seems to be the opinion of the Vilna Gaon, no, whenever it's a question of paying somebody, just like a tenant doesn't have to pay the landlord, so you also don't have to pay the teacher, so you pay zero. And the Sma is of the opinion that, you know what, it really is a loss that should be incurred by both parties because nobody really is the one who is, you know, suffering the bad luck specifically. It's the bad luck is being spread out amongst the entire region, and therefore everybody should take a hit, so you split it 50-50. So when the Chassam Sofer had a situation in Pressburg where they had a big war between Austria and France and they had to close down all the schools, and it was a question of should the teachers get paid during this period of time, Chassam Sofer said, as a pshara, as a compromise, let's follow the opinion of the Sma and pay 50%. So it's the idea of splitting the baby a little bit whenever you have these types of questions, because everybody's taking a hit. So it's appropriate, you know, for everybody to help out each other, you know, a little bit. and to take a little bit of the hit and let the other person, you know, not have to suffer too much, so that you can split it 50-50 in many of these cases when the result or the outcome from a halakhic perspective is not 100% clear. So the last question is, a family prepaid for a Pesach vacation, but due to the coronavirus, the Pesach resort needed to cancel the program. Here is not a question of a tenant canceling a lease and the landlord is ready to rent it out to somebody else. The landlord's not renting to somebody else. It's not like the program is going to still take place and the proprietors of the program are going to find somebody else or some other customer to fill the spot that was canceled by this customer. They just canceled the entire program. The question is, though, what if the person already prepaid for the entire program? The family wants its money back. The proprietors noted that there was a contractual clause that said all payments were non-refundable. Is the family entitled to a refund? So here there's a comment by Rabbi Akiva Eger in Choshen Mishpat regarding cancellation clauses, that whenever you have like a stipulation that says that regardless of what happens, a person is still going to be on the hook, that would relate to onus d'shtia. That would relate to circumstances that are foreseeable. Like it might be foreseeable that somebody, you know, that a child might break a leg, you know, God forbid. But, you know, these things happen. And then a family then decides, okay, we're not going to go. But that's like a foreseeable thing. But then he says things that are completely non-foreseeable, like, you know, an act of God, a pandemic, not something that hadn't happened in 100 years. If you didn't, like what we call a force majeure, if you didn't have a force majeure, you know, clause explicitly that said that that even if it's an act of God, the person's still going to be on the hook. So this type of a commitment, this type of an obligation that the person would undertake and that they're not going to get the money back would certainly not be enforceable. Furthermore, it's understood that when a person is agreeing to a cancellation fee, that's called an endroth. If you look in the source number 23, Chof Gimel, so the Pisgei Tshuva talks about an endroth, and endroth is like a deposit fee, that a person sometimes will make a deposit fee as a cancellation fee in the event that they're going to back out. But if the proprietor backs out, so obviously, that's not what we're talking about when a person agrees to a cancellation fee. The only thing that there's a Tosfos in Bava Metzia on a daf Ayin Chesam and Beis that talks about, or Ayin Chesam and Beis, that just talks about if a person prepays sometimes, that's an indication that they are willing to forgive the money in the event that there would be some unforeseeable event that would cause the contract not to be able to be fulfilled, even by the recipient of the money, the person who's supposed to furnish the services. So the question is, to what degree is that applicable? So that generally is applicable if the amount of money is intended to cover losses that would be sustained by the individual who's receiving the money. So in the event that there are certain losses that you can imagine that the proprietors of the event would have had to have incurred in terms of preparing for the program. For example, if they said they require a deposit for the program and just so that they can hire the waiters and they can, you know, hire, you know, the staff and they can prepare the premises and you know that they're putting that effort into place and that that money was expended in anticipation of the Pesach program, and then the Pesach program just had to be canceled last minute due to the pandemic, but it's not as if the proprietors didn't actually spend money on behalf of their patrons, and it was clear that a deposit, that a certain, you know, down payment or a certain deposit fee that was required of people at the beginning was in order to offset or cover those expenses, so then it would be reasonable to say that in those cases, the proprietors could keep a certain percentage that would cover those out-of-pocket expenses that were foreseeable even before the cancellation of the event and just return the rest of the money. But that's only if this was an amount that was required of everybody to secure a spot. If if it's just like the bad luck of the people who happen to like pay first, that, you know, their money's going to be kept and other people were not going to pay until later, it's more difficult to make that argument. But If they required everyone to pay up front because they said we're going to incur certain costs and therefore we need a certain amount of money up front for those costs that come that have to be expended before the program even begins, so then that would have been a stronger argument on behalf of the proprietors of the program. So we had these types of situations. I have, in most of the cases, the program proprietors either returned the entire amount, or when there were certain non-refundable fees that were paid up front, then they held on to those amounts, but they were generally less than 25% or less of than the entire cost of the program. I have one case where the program proprietors had received 100% from somebody and they only wanted to return 33%. They said, look, we don't have to return anything. It said, that this is it's non-refundable. And we had to explain to them that that doesn't really work, where number one, there's an act of God, and number two, the costs that are being paid are really for services that were never actually furnished. So in the end, we were able to work out a pshara. Actually, that case wasn't the PaySup program case. That case was a person who had paid a caterer for a wedding. And they said, we already expended lots of costs, in preparation of the wedding. I said, but we weren't allowed, based on the rules, to have the wedding. And therefore, we were able to work out a settlement where they paid back to customers the vast majority of the money, which generally is good business practice if you want people to come back afterwards. But a number of places did was like camp programs, for example, they just returned everything. And they said, we're going to give 100% refunds, even though they could have made an argument to keep a certain amount, because it's just really good customer relations. What's important to bear in mind in these cases is that everybody suffered, everybody took a loss. It was a very nice sentiment that was expressed by my Rebbe Rav Mordechai Willichlita. Points out that when Avraham Avinu rescued his nephew Lot from the kings, the four kings who had defeated the five kings, and then he rescued the five kings and Lot, and then the king of Sodom, was one of the five kings, was so happy that Avraham had prevailed in the war and he got all of the booty back and he got all the people back. So he said, "Tei nefesh rechush kachlach." He said, "Just give me the people, and you could keep all the spoils of the wars." Rabbi Willett said, "It's the same idea. When you have something like this massive pandemic and so many people, Rahman al-Islam, passed away, the attitude should be Tei nefesh. The main thing is to stay healthy and to be alive and to have the nefesh rechush kachlach, and the money." The money we could be generous about in terms of settling, these disputes and recognize that people are suffering financially and go above and beyond the letter of the law in terms of compromising when it comes to these cases. And that's what we've generally recommended in these landlord-tenant disputes and the like, that people should try to reach a resolution in the spirit of compromise. But these are the general principles and parameters. Again, next week, I will be away. Mr. Chairman, we should resume 2 weeks from tonight.
I found that here you said the basic programs were about a third was the standard.
Yeah, 25% to a third. Yeah.